Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Take a listen to this news clip from the archives.
We're going to begin here with the outbreak of a mystery virus in China that now has the World Health Organization on edge.
China has identified the cause of the mysterious pneumonia outbreak in Wuhan City. It's a new type of coronavirus.
So that was in January of this year. It feels like an eternity ago, and it can seem so frustrating that this pandemic is still going on. People are still dying. We don't have a vaccine yet. But scientists only identified this virus 9 months ago. That's not a long time. And many breakthroughs have happened since.
We are moving at an unprecedented rate with unprecedented resources and a common target.
That's NYU medical ethicist Art Kaplan. He says scientists around the world are working together really quickly with a lot of funding and support to find a vaccine, treatment, and a cure. That's the good news.
But science tells us that you got to hold on to the handrail, get the data. The odds of hurting you are bigger than the odds of helping you, the less you know about a particular treatment.
Art says the push for quick breakthroughs and treatments is so great that some of the usual steps that make the scientific process safe have fallen by the wayside.
So you get all kinds of what I call panic prescribing. People saying, hey, I saw somewhere that one guy did a study on two people and it looked interesting and we don't have any other cure, so try this.
But this is a desperate situation and patients who are really sick want options.
I don't have time to wait for these studies. Anything you've got, try it on me.
The pandemic has put a lot of stress on the scientific process and our healthcare system, exposing weaknesses that have long existed but have become impossible to ignore. On this episode, Science and Medicine Under Pressure. Let's start with research. It usually moves at its own pace, and it's more of a turtle than a hare. The system is designed with careful steps that build on each other. Checks and balances are in place that are supposed to catch errors in study design and flaws in the data, all to make sure that scientists get it right and patients are safe. Over the years, some researchers and patients have argued that the system is too slow, that it's making it too hard to get new treatments, or even discouraging innovation. And now we're suddenly in overdrive, sidestepping some of the safeguards to get results faster. Add to that a highly polarized political landscape and the fact that this is the first global pandemic in the age of social media, where any new piece of information, true or not, can be shared to millions of people instantly. It makes for a pretty stressful situation. Nina Feldman has this story about one drug that's gotten caught up in this mix, and it's not the one you may be thinking about.
From the very first days of the pandemic, Alexis Lieberman felt she had to do something. She's a pediatrician in Philadelphia, and infectious diseases are not her specialty. But like a lot of doctors, she felt it was her role to help in a medical emergency. She talked about this with her dad, a retired physician.
And the first thing that he said to me was, we've got to find a drug that will stop it from progressing so that you can give it to people at the first sign of illness or maybe even the first sign of possible illness and have most people not progress to end up in the hospital. So that was the goal.
Alexis took his words to heart. She started to spend her evenings scrolling through the doctor Facebook group she's a part of to see what people were doing.
There were people who were just trying things. That's it, trying things. Especially ICU doctors and hospitalists were just trying things to see what would work. So I read all of these, I think I'm not exaggerating if I say 10,000 posts in the space of, you know, the month of March. And everything anybody said they had tried that they thought might work, I wrote down.
That's her lapdog panting in the background. Anyway, Alexis spent hours digging deeper, pursuing leads, cross-referencing drugs people mentioned with the risks. She ruled out the drugs with too many potential side effects. And what she was left with was an inexpensive, low-risk, anti-parasitic drug called ivermectin. It's used all the time in India and Latin America to treat worms and to treat heartworm in pets. Ivermectin had been shown to slow the replication of other viruses in cells, like dengue and yellow fever. And it's considered very safe. So when one of her best friends called her with COVID symptoms, Alexis asked if she wanted to try ivermectin.
We kind of thought, well, there's no negatives to taking this. It's not going to have, you know, any really bad side effects. It could help. Why not?
That's Alexis's longtime family friend, Heather Coots.
So she prescribed ivermectin to me, and within 2 days, I felt like normal again. It was super quick.
So that was pretty astounding. Not proof of anything, but pretty astounding.
Meanwhile, some more evidence had emerged to support the use of ivermectin for COVID. A group of Australian researchers added the drug to cells infected with the coronavirus in a test tube. Within 48 hours, essentially all the viral material was gone. These results were not a miracle cure. The dose of ivermectin used on the cells was way too high to be safe in the human body. Still, the researchers wrote that ivermectin could slow the replication of the virus in humans, even at lower doses. Alexis was encouraged by these results and her success with Heather. So she started prescribing ivermectin to other people with COVID. And it seemed like it worked. Excited to share, she started posting about it in one of her doctor's Facebook groups and telling her colleagues. The response she got was very negative.
I even interacted with another friend who's a doctor, and I threw it out as an idea. And she responded by saying, we could try Eye of Newt as well. Very sarcastic, very, you are doing witchcraft, you're not doing medicine. And that's been the tone. Why don't we try some mugwort? You know, why don't we try some fairy dust?
Alexis was surprised. It's common for doctors to prescribe off-label drugs with a safe track record. And more small studies were coming out showing ivermectin had promise. Alexis was confused. What happened to the spirit of experimentation that had flooded the Facebook pages just a few months earlier? What had happened was hydroxychloroquine. President Donald Trump hailed the anti-malarial drug as a potential game changer, with very little scientific evidence backing his claim. It sparked a shortage of the drug and a frenzy of self-medication. So now, many doctors were wary of even talking about any promising drug without enough evidence to back it. And some people said that what little research there was for ivermectin didn't look promising. They pointed to that toxic dosage level from the test tube study.
They said, forget it. The concentration is too high. Kill it right away.
That's Carlos Shakur. He's a researcher in Spain who's been studying ivermectin for over a decade. When the pandemic hit, he was planning to conduct a trial to see if ivermectin could help with COVID. But like Alexis, Carlos was flooded with responses telling him not to bother. And what's more, that researching the drug would be irresponsible.
I got super annoyed at that guy calling me. The way I describe what he did is he gringo-splained ivermectin to me.
Wait, which guy?
Well, this some researcher, some Anglo-Saxon researcher calling to gringo-splain me my drug and say, oh, I want to add to your thinking because you should consider this and why it should work. The dose is too high. Oh, wow, don't tell me.
Carlos has been studying ivermectin for most of his career, which means that he understands its limitations too. Just like the people who were afraid that ivermectin could become the next hydroxychloroquine, Carlos was afraid of what would happen if a desperate public caught wind of a promising drug without enough research to back it. And in fact, thousands of miles away, in the depths of the Peruvian rainforest, that was already happening. Peru was hit hard by COVID, and it was especially difficult to treat indigenous communities in its remote Amazonian region. By mid-May, hospital beds there were overflowing and oxygen supply was running out. Ivermectin is already popular and available over the counter in Peru for the treatment of worms. So when the test tube study came out, health officials there took note. This could be huge. Soon after, what seemed like another promising study came out. A Chicago-based company called Surgisphere released a huge pool of patient data from more than 1,000 hospitals across the world. Researchers published preprints, or studies that haven't yet been peer-reviewed, drawing from that data. And one showed ivermectin reduced the death rate of COVID patients by 83%. But a few weeks later, it turned out the data from this study was not reliable. The journals that published those studies retracted them.
The preprint just disappeared. There's a ghost of this preprint driving policy decisions all through Latin America.
It was too late. The health ministries in Peru and Bolivia had already added ivermectin into their national COVID guidelines. The Peruvian president promoted ivermectin and said there was no time for evidence-based science.
Well, you can say, well, what's the risk, Carlos? This drug is very safe. Well, there is a risk. What happens is that this drug is widely available as veterinary formulation. So if you decide to buy it and inject yourself with whatever amount you want, it's very difficult to control that. And that's exactly what has happened in Peru and Bolivia.
In the Peruvian jungle, local news outlets reported a group of evangelical missionaries worked with a province leader to offer thousands of free injections of ivermectin. In some cases, the reports said it was the kind designed for animals.
So, okay, you want to inject 5,000 people with the drug that is destined for veterinary uses. All right, who's following up on that? Who's checking if there were pregnant women? Who is checking if somebody had convulsions? Nobody. You just go in, you do a humanitarian service, you leave.
As for whether it worked, COVID cases did subside in June in the Peruvian jungle provinces. But because it was used so widely, it's very difficult to isolate ivermectin as the cause of the drop. Cases are back up now in Peru. After Brazil, it has the most COVID deaths in South America. Back in Philly, Alexis Lieberman understands these risks. But the way she sees it, that's all the more reason to run a big study and show that either ivermectin works or it doesn't. There was already a doctor in Florida who was treating patients with the drug and publishing promising results. And there was research from Iraq showing that ivermectin sped up recovery time. But those were observational studies. Basically, they analyzed data in retrospect. To really prove something works, researchers want a double-blind, randomized control trial, the gold standard. Alexis just can't wrap her mind around why a large research institution wouldn't take that on.
I don't know that ivermectin would fix it, but I will tell you that I've given it to a dozen people and they've all gotten better in about 48 hours. It's worth one big, fast, well-designed, well-funded study that I think the government should pay for.
Alexis assembled a group of doctors from around the world who'd also had some success with ivermectin, and they tried to get their own trial off the ground. But they couldn't really get any traction. It's hard to design and build a study like that without the backing of a large research institution. Alexis even asked for help from someone at Merck, the pharmaceutical company that developed ivermectin back in the 80s.
So we read your case series, and we ran our models, and we do not think it is plausible, so we will not be pursuing research on ivermectin.
Merck declined my interview request, but sent me a statement that said basically the same thing. It is worth noting that Merck's patent for ivermectin expired in 1995. They're in the process of creating a new compound treatment for COVID-19 and are also involved in vaccine trials. Across the country from Alexis, a Malibu-based researcher named Sabine Hazen hasn't been surprised that it's been a slog to garner interest in ivermectin.
You know, nobody wants to invest in trials in medications that are cheap because they're not making any money.
Sabine's a gastroenterologist by training, but has managed to get a study for ivermectin as a COVID treatment approved by the FDA. If there's one thing she's good at, it's running clinical trials. She's done more than 150 for pharmaceutical companies. Sabine's true passion is not viruses, but the microbiome, or the bacteria and other organisms that make up our guts.
Midlife crisis. I told my husband, I'm like, look, I'm not buying a Lamborghini. I'm buying a $250,000 machine to analyze stools and understand life.
When the pandemic hit, she wanted to keep running trials for her own research. but she couldn't even get patients to come to the clinic. No one seemed to care about the gut anymore.
We all want to go back to treating what we were supposed to be treating, you know, other diseases. There's not only COVID-19 in the world. You know, people are dying of other things. So the sooner we get rid of COVID-19, the sooner we can go back to what we were doing.
So Sabine teamed up with another doctor and submitted a clinical trial protocol for ivermectin. She didn't do it for the money. She knew because ivermectin is generic, there's not much to be made on it. But she figured this would be the fastest path back to her passion.
I honestly think there's something wrong with me because I play with poop. I play with a dangerous virus. And I play with I'm in bed with pharma and the FDA. And let's not forget the FDA.
But it's because of Sabine's experience working with the regulatory agencies and her financial situation that she was able to get the trial off the ground. She'll have to supply more than 300 patients with heart monitoring holters, pulse oximeters, and testing swabs at their homes. She'll hire nurses to come out and draw people's blood. Sabine is paying out of her own savings. She hopes the trials will attract the attention of pharmaceutical companies who will eventually invest, but she hasn't had any luck so far. In the meantime, Alexis is still offering ivermectin to COVID patients in Philadelphia. She always includes the caveat that it's not FDA approved for this, but it's generally safe, and there are a few promising studies supporting its use. She tries to resist drifting towards conspiracy theories that there's a concerted effort to stamp out the drug.
You don't need a special conspiracy. You don't need a cabal of people in a back room saying, oh, let's make sure this one doesn't go because we're going to make more money off of the other one. I don't think you need that. I think you just have a million small actors who act in their small field and are completely ruled by what will make money.
She figures the drug's not lucrative, so it's just not a priority. But for her, as long as people are still dying, it is.
That was Nina Feldman reporting. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan from NYU hopes that one lesson that could come out of this time period is to build on the current global spirit of collaboration between scientists, to make that more of the norm in research.
The old system paid attention as much to property, equity, patents, as it did speed. And so what was the real reason for slowing down sometimes? It was that you didn't want to share anything with anybody until you got a patent on it. I think that's anti-public interest. Sure, we can patent things, and sure, we want people to make their money through their discoveries, but that doesn't mean we can't create a system where people can share information and then still guarantee that they can patent or protect their discoveries. We've got to come up with a system of research that says we're trying to reward maximizing speed to achieve public health.
The pandemic has put a lot of pressure on our healthcare system and the field of medical research. We're talking about issues and flaws that have become more pronounced during this time. We just heard about some researchers who are looking into ivermectin as a potential treatment for coronavirus. There are some steroids that doctors are using. There's remdesivir. And of course, there was hydroxychloroquine, which got an FDA emergency use authorization at the end of March. Every time an existing drug seems to have promise, it creates a bit of a run on this product, which can result in shortages. But drug shortages existed before the pandemic. How do they happen, and have they gotten worse? Alan Yu reports.
Rebecca Mosner has been taking hydroxychloroquine for years.
I live every day in some sort of pain. I have pain in my hands, which, you know, feels like I can't open my hands all the way, close them. I can't write for a long period of time.
She has an autoimmune disease called Sjogren's syndrome, where her immune system attacks her own body by mistake. Like Rebecca, a lot of people with autoimmune disorders take the drug, sold under the brand name Plaquenil, to control their symptoms and debilitating pain. Usually, she can get her prescription refilled immediately. But that changed in March, when there was a lot of hype about hydroxychloroquine as a potential treatment for COVID-19.
I got really scared, and I immediately called my local pharmacy. They said to me, we don't have any Plaquenil, because I was already at that point, bad timing, almost out of Plaquenil. So I started calling pharmacies locally within about a 2-hour drive. Nobody had any Plaquenil.
She had about 11 pills left, so 11 days worth. She called 20 other pharmacies. She talked to her doctor, made a plan for what other medicine she could use if she ran out. When she was down to 2 pills left, she finally managed to get more. Drug distributors felt this crunch as well. They're the middlemen that get drugs from manufacturers to buyers. Chip Davis is the CEO of the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, the trade organization for drug distributors. He said that distributors usually look at historic patterns for how many drugs go where and can plan for it, but this was an unusual circumstance.
I remember talking to the CEOs of one of our member companies who expressed to me that they received a call from one of their leading healthcare system providers saying their normal ordering cycle was X number of doses of hydroxychloroquine on a roughly a 45-day basis. And the next call that came in, they were requesting 100X.
If the distributor had filled out that order as requested, then other places that need hydroxychloroquine would be left without any. Chip says the pandemic tested the supply chain for drugs, but did not break it, proving its resilience, unlike, say, what happened with N95 masks and toilet paper. In the case of hydroxychloroquine, the Food and Drug Administration revoked its emergency use authorization later in June, saying the evidence had changed. But over the past few years, patients have had difficulty getting all kinds of drugs for other reasons. Ethan Daniels was 11 when he was diagnosed with cancer in 2017. He had 3.5 years of chemotherapy and had to go to the hospital once a month to get his chemo treatment.
The side effects of the treatment were pretty bad. I lost my hair twice, and I was throwing up all the time. It makes you sick on your stomach. I can't feel my hands or feet, and my bones are not what they were used to be. They're pretty brittle now, and I couldn't sleep at night.
That was a lot to deal with. Then in late 2019, one routine hospital visit did not go as planned.
The scariest day of my life was finding out I had cancer. Until one day when we went to the hospital and then we got told they didn't have the life-saving chemo that we needed.
A manufacturer for the drug stopped making it earlier that year, telling the FDA it was a business decision. Ethan had to go home and wait for updates. He missed 2 doses. Fortunately, he did not see any physical changes from that. In June, he had his last dose and is in remission. Ryan Marable manages a pharmacy for the grocery store company Kroger. He says drug shortages have become very common. For example, this June, a drug company had to recall a common drug for type 2 diabetes because of an impurity.
We may have had maybe 2,000 tablets that immediately had to be taken off of our shelves, and we had to contact the patients immediately and let them know of the situation. So those patients now have not only have to go without their medication, but they now have to worry about the implications on their blood sugar. You know, how are they going to keep their condition under control?
Ryan says these problems disproportionately affect people who can't shop around at different pharmacies. Maybe their insurance policy doesn't cover it, or maybe they just don't have a car. And even if their doctors and pharmacies can find some other drug in the meantime, that substitute might not work as well.
Now we're sacrificing outcomes for access to the medication due to economic decisions that have to be made.
Patients have actually died because of drug shortages. For example, pharmacists reported deaths from patients who had an infection and could not get the one antibiotic or antiviral drug that is known to work. So why do these shortages happen? Erin Fox is a senior pharmacy director at University of Utah Health. She says one part of the problem is the supply chain. Drugs are made, shipped, and given to patients just in time, without much slack or resiliency.
We don't have three months, 6 months of drug just lying around. The system has really been designed over the past few years to try to be as lean as possible. That's all fine if every part of that system is working well, but if a manufacturer has a small glitch, that means that wholesalers are out very quickly and hospitals run out very quickly.
Pharmacies don't keep a large supply of drugs lying around because that would take up a lot of space. For example, Erin says her healthcare system stocks around 5,000 drugs and typically keeps enough on hand for 5 to 14 days. You'd need a giant warehouse if you kept a year's worth of everything. Then there's the manufacturing side. A few manufacturers make a lot of the prescription drugs. So if those few companies run into quality control problems and have to recall a drug, there are not a lot of other companies to turn to. Erin says it's hard to get a sense of which plants might have problems that lead to recalls because consumers or even pharmacists do not get to see the quality reports that the FDA does. All they know is the drug is either safe to be sold or it isn't.
The FDA, we know, sees very different levels of quality between manufacturers. Some might be at that A-plus level. Others might be at that kind of C-minus, D-plus, barely passing level. But those differences between companies and products are not relayed or visible in any way to people that are purchasing the medicines and making decisions about which medicines are going to be stocked at a hospital system, like people like me.
By the time consumers find out about a drug recall, it might already be too late. A tragic example of this happened in 2008, when patients died from contaminated doses of the blood thinner heparin. And there's another question that's really important here. How much of any given drug comes from which manufacturing plant? Health economist Rena Conti has spent a lot of time on this.
Pharmaceutical companies are required to tell the regulator of the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, where products are made. But they are not required to tell the U.S. regulators in what volume they're made or in what capacity that specific plant can make drugs if needed. And so that is a problem because let's say there is a weather-related event that shuts down one plant. It takes work for the FDA to figure out, okay, how much of U.S. drug supply is actually affected by that plant.
Drugs are also made overseas, like in China and India. Rena questions, how are consumers supposed to figure out whether trade disputes between the US and those countries might affect the medicine they need?
These are the most intimate consumer products that people consume in their homes every day. There is absolutely no reason why we shouldn't know where these products are made and shouldn't be able to judge for ourselves the quality of these products.
Rena says there should be a lot more transparency in the drug manufacturing system, because right now it is a problem that a small minority of drug companies take advantage of. By the way, she says even if all the drugs were made in the US, which is unlikely, that wouldn't make that much of a difference if consumers don't get any more information about where the drugs are made and how well the companies are meeting manufacturing standards. So why don't consumers know more about quality and manufacturing of drugs? I put that question to Anne Pritchett, Senior Vice President of Policy and Research, at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, a trade group.
The FDA actually does have a substantial amount of information. That information is not reported publicly, in part because that's competitive, sensitive business information of manufacturers as to where they're manufacturing and at what volume. And what we wouldn't want to see is there be premature reporting to the public that could actually exacerbate shortages. So for example, if there's increased demand for a certain drug, you might see gray market or secondary distributors buy up that drug and impose significant price increases if they think it's going to be subject to potential shortage. So we have to ensure that we're avoiding unintended consequences in terms of reporting to the public.
That's an interesting point. I guess what that makes me think of, though, I mean, aren't there anti-price gouging laws specifically to prevent that kind of scenario?
There are in the states, but not every state has them. And of course, that does require that there is reporting of that information to authorities. And we have encouraged, particularly at the state level, that there be more education and that there be diligence applied, particularly in times of crisis.
She added, a shortage like the one with the cancer drug Ethan used is unusual. And in that case, the manufacturer did tell the FDA they were going to stop making the drugs as they were supposed to. The FDA said in an email that, among other things, their top priority is to ensure access to safe and effective medicine, and that they work immediately with the medical field and drug companies whenever shortages happen. Erin Fox, the senior pharmacy director, says there is one solution that hospitals have worked on by themselves: change the model for buying drugs altogether. Right now, hospitals buy in bulk, but the drug companies don't really know in advance how much a hospital is going to buy.
It's really a guessing game for other companies, and so that's part of why we run into supply disruptions.
However, hundreds of hospitals around the country, including the one Erin works at, got together to form Civica Rx, a not-for-profit company. Erin is on their advisory committee. Civica requires hospitals to commit to buying a supply of certain drugs for 5 years, and they will be guaranteed to get it.
They might be paying a little bit more for those products, but the shortages are so devastating and so difficult that it's worth it.
But health economist Rina Conti says these kinds of market solutions can only go so far. She says the drug shortage problem is systemic, and truly getting to the root of it would require legislative changes.
That was Alan Yu reporting. We're talking about healthcare issues that existed before the pandemic but have become more pronounced during this time. Coronavirus has had an especially devastating effect on Black Americans. Infection rates are higher than among white Americans, as well as the rate of hospitalization and death. This has been attributed to disparities that have long plagued our health system: lack of access to care, more underlying health conditions, and discrimination in terms of the care they receive. A recent ProPublica report exposed some of those flaws in the system. Two investigative reporters noticed that in New Orleans, a lot of elderly patients had died at home from the coronavirus. They reached out to the patients' families to talk about what kind of care they had received. And they found out that in about 24 cases, patients had gone to the hospital to get treatment and were sent back home for hospice care.
And of those 24 or so patients where we heard this, every single one of them was Black.
That's Joshua Kaplan, a senior reporting fellow at ProPublica. He and reporter Annie Waldman wanted to know why these patients had been sent home. They obtained medical records, interviewed healthcare workers and family members. For example, the children of 86-year-old Sarah Johnson, a retired nurse. She had gotten sick with coronavirus in early April.
The week Sarah Johnson went into the hospital was kind of in the height of the first wave of the pandemic in New Orleans. And she went to Ochsner West Bank, which is part of this large network of hospitals that fall under Ochsner Health.
The hospital was overwhelmed.
Staff were short, nurses were scrambling to take care of multiple critically ill patients that normally might get their undivided attention.
After Sarah was in the hospital for 23 hours, the family was told there was nothing more that could be done for her, that her kidneys were failing. The reporters asked other doctors to review those medical charts, and they disagreed. They said Sarah seemed to be responding to treatments.
One said that with a few more days of just being in the hospital and getting hydrated, he thinks she probably could have survived this whole thing. And instead, they sent her home to hospice, where meaningful treatment stopped entirely, and her family had to go through this horrific experience.
Annie, what was she supposed to get care at home from hospice care workers, or what was supposed to happen next?
Yeah, so under normal times, hospice is supposed to visit multiple times a week, checking in constantly on families to make sure that they're okay, taking care of their loved ones as they're in their final days. But during the pandemic, this all shifted. Hospice workers told us that they were under many of the same pressures that hospitals were under during this time. And when Sarah Johnson came home from the hospital, you know, she essentially came home with a bed, oxygen tanks, morphine, and the hospice company trained her family on how to administer morphine. So this is a family that's completely untrained in end-of-life care, who has an infectious family member coming back into the household where they have no proper protective equipment, and they're expected to care for her in her final days. She survived about 10 days before she passed away, and her family feels that she suffered in her final moments because they did not have hospice nurses at their side guiding them through the process, particularly as she developed a constellation of symptoms in her final moments.
Hospice care is supposed to be a way to emphasize quality of life when a patient is critically ill, where you stop aggressive and painful treatments to make sure the patient is comfortable. But Sarah Johnson's family said they felt pressure to transfer her into hospice. And several other Black families Annie and Joshua spoke to said the same thing.
One thing that I don't think has been very much examined is how race factors into communication and decision-making around health. End-of-life care is extremely subtle. There are no right answers. There are these massive questions families have to wrestle with, and it requires a lot of sensitivity. And research has shown that even before the pandemic, Black patients had worse experiences with this, receive worse communication, receive less contact, felt their loved ones' pain went unmanaged more frequently. And if anything, the pandemic threw a wrench in that already delicate balance. And so I think that is something that we all need to reckon with as we move forward in this pandemic.
As they collected more data, they contacted the Ochsner Hospital System for a response.
While Black people died from the virus at a disproportionate rate in New Orleans, white people actually died outside of the hospitals at a slightly higher rate than Black people, and in most of the cases we looked at, this was by choice. We spoke with three families of white people who died at home or with hospice care at home, and their family said that they actually chose to avoid the hospital and made arrangements to stay at home instead. What the spokesperson for Ochsner said about the fact that so many of the patients that we spoke to were Black patients, they said that it was because of disproportionate rates of infection, hospitalization, and deaths, and that they seemed to be sicker when they arrived in the emergency room with a higher rate of kidney or liver function abnormalities. But they didn't answer our specific questions about racial disparities in hospice referrals, especially when we asked them about the number of patients that we heard that felt pressured into hospice care. And essentially, they said that they've known about these disparities for decades, and that this is an opportunity to address disparities head on and initiate change.
Since this story came out, Joshua and Annie have heard from other people with similar experiences.
They just want answers and transparency. I think what's unique about the pandemic is that so many individuals went into the hospital, and then because of the visitor policies, because of the infectious nature of the disease, they were cut off from their loved ones in the hospitals. And I think that many families are looking for answers, for information, for transparency about what went on in these hospital rooms that they couldn't enter.
Annie Waldman is a reporter at ProPublica. Joshua Kaplan is a senior reporting fellow. Together, they wrote an article titled Sent Home to Die. We'll put a link on our website, whyy.org/thepulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. The pandemic has put a lot of pressure on our healthcare system, and some flaws and weaknesses have become more pronounced and visible during this time. Imagine you're still pretty new at your job, and you get tossed right into a high-stakes life-or-death situation. That's been the experience for many residents, doctors who have recently completed medical school and are now working in hospitals to train in a specialty of their choice. It's a notoriously stressful training period, and residents work long hours. And it seems like during the pandemic, things got worse. Grant Hill reports.
If you ever wondered what it's like being a doctor fresh out of med school, Andy Hyatt, a third-year psychiatry resident at Cambridge Health Alliance, recommends watching the show Scrubs.
This year is going to be hell. You're going to be overworked and underpaid. We're going to treat you like crap, and some of you won't be coming back. It will be, as always, a complete and utter suckfest. I hope you enjoyed orientation.
Andy is a representative for a residents' union in Massachusetts, and he was trying to make this long period of training suck less. Then COVID-19 happened.
You know, we were about to kind of revisit the whole contract and open negotiations when, of course, we had a pandemic of, you know, historic proportions hit, and no one had the capacity to do anything.
Everyone at his hospital jumped into action. The intensive care unit was chaotic. Dentists were called in to help answer phones. But as things started to plateau, Andy noticed a pattern.
A lot of the more experienced physicians or people who had more outpatient practices, they just stopped seeing patients in person. And it became the case that most of the people who were seeing patients face-to-face were the residents. And that was scary. I remember it's like terrifying. Like, we're the ones who are expected to go in and work in the ED and like are seeing sick people who, you know, at this time there were no tests available. Like, well, we're the ones who are going to be seeing people face to face.
Andy says that in the face of this unknown, contagious, deadly illness, the least experienced doctors were relied on the most. And he wasn't exactly surprised by that because residents tend to run the show, pandemic or not.
The secret that, you know, I'm not sure how many people kind of realize this, but all these kind of big name hospitals, you know, the residents are the ones who are really running things, which is kind of really ironic that like you're in this big name famous place and the people who are really taking care of most of the patients are, you know, people with anywhere from 2 weeks of residency training to, you know, a couple of years, of course, supervised by kind of attending physicians, but we're the ones who are kind of doing most of the work.
About one out of every 7 physicians in the U.S. is a resident or fellow, according to the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education, or ACGME. This is a powerful organization that sets requirements for residency programs in the U.S. I talked to John Combs, a physician and communications officer for this organization. He says the balance between hands-on experience and training that's supposed to be a part of residency was thrown off by the pandemic.
We heard very early on that many of the organizations were struggling to provide both education and clinical care to their programs.
John says that some hospitals were immediately overwhelmed during the early days of COVID-19. So educational requirements were suspended and residents were scheduled based on need rather than the specialty they were supposed to train for.
We basically said, it's all hands on deck. We're freeing residents to move to wherever the institution needs them to take care of patients.
John says his organization still kept basic requirements in place for hospitals in hard-hit areas. The number of hours residents were allowed to work, 80 per week, remained unchanged, and supervision by a senior physician was still a must.
We wanted to make sure that they were adequately supervised during that time, that they were trained in the use of PPE and infection control, so that the residents could remain safe if they were moved to other services.
Despite those efforts, some residents say there were times where things just felt plain unsafe and unfair.
When the pandemic hit, all of a sudden, you know, the N95 masks were just gone.
That's Spruha Mogadia. She's a fourth-year resident of podiatric surgery at Temple University Hospital in Philadelphia.
And, you know, a lot of the OR staff, you know, many nurses and all of the attending all had it. But I remember, you know, us as residents having to, like, scrounge for an N95 mask. And to this day, actually, there are several of us that have yet to actually have an N95 mask.
To be clear, residents in the emergency department were outfitted with N95 masks. But Spruha says others like her were not. Residents can file a complaint about working conditions or not getting enough training to the ACGME, the organization that sets the requirements for residency programs. Here's John Combs again.
We did hear from lots of residents. Most of them did not rise to the level of a complaint about a requirement violation.
In fact, John says none of the complaints they've received so far during the pandemic have risen to that level. Of course, it can be tough for many residents to speak out in the first place.
You know, in a lot of hospitals, like, residents are afraid to report because it'll, you know, you say a report's anonymous, but residency programs often aren't that big. And like in any workplace, like, how anonymous is an anonymous report?
That's Andy Hyatt again. He says that because of this, some residents feel like the system is stacked against them and has been for a while. For example, take that 80-hour work week that was in place even prior to the pandemic. It's up to residents in his hospital to self-report working hours.
And if you report things that violate duty hours, it'll give you an error message. It'll be like, sorry, no, this violates duty hours. You can't put this in because it couldn't be true. And so if you actually did work that time, like, the system, this like software, won't actually allow you to do it.
The pandemic, the hours, the pay, it all has left some residents feeling low. Spruha is on a wellness committee at her hospital, and she's concerned.
You know, a lot of residents, like, want to stay strong and don't want to be seen as weak, so they don't say anything, quite frankly, to their mentors or even to their peers. And I think that has to change, that if you're feeling burnt out, that has nothing to do with you being weak.
Both Andy and Spruha stressed that the pandemic has only reinforced their passion and appreciation for their jobs, patients, superiors, and hospitals. They just want to make things better for residents to come.
This is a good opportunity to really change the healthcare system on how it treats all of its workers and, you know, and really welcome an influx of people wanting to contribute during a time that has now become uncertain.
That story was reported by Grant Hill. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, and Jad Slayman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral Health Reporting on the Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's Health and Science Reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.